Mr. Mutimer, reel 9.
In other words, taking a leaf out of the good book. Greater love hath no man than this, that he give up his freedom for his friend. That's the way I thought of it anyway. But we really couldn't believe our eyes to see this petty officer walk back into the camp. He couldn't leave his friend. Now, I think earlier on, in fact, I know I did, mention that I was the news hand for our hut. When we used to get the 6 o'clock BBC news at night, I used to go back and read it in the various rooms. Well, towards the end of the war, in the early part of 1945, I started to make maps of Europe, and I used to bring them up to date every night after we'd got the news. And then, as time went on, the weeks went on, and we could see that the war was really coming to an end in a 2 or 3 months' time, I nailed these maps up on the bulkhead, and I made little flags, German, British, Russian, and so on, and stuck them in the map so that we could see exactly who was doing what. And I didn't think that there was any danger in this from the guards, because by this time, I think they were as fed up with the war and not being at home and being with their families as we were. And as a matter of fact, when they found that I'd put these maps up, one or two of them used to come in every morning to see how they were getting on. And of course, they couldn't believe their eyes, because the German media was telling them one thing, and I was getting the news from the BBC, which was telling us something else. And they just couldn't believe that they were losing the war as rapidly as they were when they saw my little flags keep creeping up and the Russians keep creeping down.
Did they dispute what you'd put?
Oh, at first they did. Yes, they disputed it. And, of course, they wanted to know how we got the information. They were told to mind their own business in no uncertain terms. But, of course, they must have realised how we were getting the information, because they had found from time to time radios. But, however, it didn't seem to worry them. They'd given up more or less by this time, about February, March time. And so, as I say, they used to come in every morning to see how they were getting on. And they didn't like what they saw. And they used to have a little discussion with us and try and say, well, our German people say this and this and this is happening, and you say that and that and that is happening. Who is right? We're right, of course. How do you know? Ah, we get the information, the real information. You don't want to believe what you've got in your papers. That's a load of balderdash. So, as I say, they used to come and look at the maps that I'd made and the little flags. Now then, I will go back a little bit to the show that we put on called Merry England, because there is a little bit here which I wish to talk about, which shows just how appreciative prisoners of war were to one another. Now, in Merry England, I was playing the part of the May Queen. Now, when the show was on, it meant that you were over in the theatre for about 5 hours. The show took about 3 hours on stage. You had to be there an hour before to make up and get costumed up. And it took about an hour after the show to take the makeup off and stow the costumes away and all that sort of thing. Well, on the opening night of Merry England, I happened to mention in the dressing room And remember, this was in midwinter. There was about 3 feet of snow outside, and we had no heating in the theatre. But I happened to mention that all I'd had to eat that night before coming over the theatre to do the show was one potato and a slice of black bread. And the Royal Marine Sergeant Gunner, who was playing the part of Queen Elizabeth, said to me, "You've really had only that to eat and you're going to be over here for 5 hours?" I said, "Well, yeah, I'm afraid that's right, Fairy." His name was Fairclough. She said, "Good Lord." Well, we did the show, and the next morning there was a knock on the door of my room, and there stood a Royal Marine with a Red Cross parcel box, and he said, "Here you are, scribes, this is for you. Some of the lads have got together and collected a little bit of food for you. They heard that you'd been over there and done that show last night on a slice of black bread and one potato." I said, "Well, that's jolly good." And sure enough, the box was about half full of tins of one sort and the other. And all the time that this show was running, every morning there was a knock on the door and there would be somebody or other with some tins of food for me. My oppo, Stoker Petty Officer Chalmers, with whom I used to share my Red Cross parcel, he said, "I hope this bloody show goes on for about a month." He said, "We're living all right doing on this. He said, "Keep it up, Herbie boy." But it only went on for a fortnight.
When you said that there was a knock on the door of your room,
yes,
what type of accommodation did you have?
Well, it was a long hut with a dozen rooms in it. The rooms were about 12 feet square, and there were 6 2-tiered bunks in each room. And on the end of the hut were 2 smaller rooms, in which were 2 POWs, usually a chief petty officer or a petty officer or both. They lived in there, and that was the hut Führer's room, in charge of the hut. And the other small room kept all the buckets and mops and cleaning materials and that sort of thing. That's what the accommodation was like. But there were 12 in a room, and there were about a dozen rooms in each hut, with the 2 small ones on the end.
And people would normally knock on the door before they went in, would they?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. As you would on board a ship before you went in a mess. I mean, this is only normal politeness.
Who gave them the name the Hut Führer? Was it your nickname for them?
Yeah, a nickname for them. He was a hut leader in charge of the hut, you see. Over in the officers' compound was an army dentist. And he didn't have much equipment with which to do or give dental treatment, particularly when it came to fillings. And the way he used to fill teeth was he'd get silver paper out of cigarette cartons and he'd melt it down and use that as the amalgam or the filling for the teeth. And it seemed to work quite successfully, really. I never had any of mine done, but I never heard anyone complain about toothache and that sort of thing. I think he must have done a very good job. Well, now, we come up to my birthday, the 10th of April, 1945. And this is the day on which we were kicked out of the camp and taken on the forced march. That's when it began. I was outside of my hut on that day, sunning myself, and about 12:30, the camp guards, plus or backed up by some special guards, came rushing into the camp and said we were going to be moved by road within the hour. that we were to pack our belongings. The destination was unknown. The parcel store would be thrown open, and we could take what we wanted from it. And they did just that. Now, as I said just now, in these huts, we were in rooms of a dozen people. Well, we 12 in our room had a very hurried meeting and decided that we would stick together on the road. And we also decided that we would not take a lot of useless gear, such as books and pyjamas and blankets. We would travel as light as possible, replacing those things with tins of stuff out of the Red Cross parcel store, such as soap, chocolate, coffee and cigarettes, because those four commodities were the currency in Germany. We knew not where we were going, how long we would be on the road, and we considered that it would be better to have a full belly than carry a load of useless stuff like books with us. So that's what we did. We went down to the Red Cross parcel store and we loaded up with soap, coffee and chocolate and cigarettes. And we took with us just three or four changes of socks, because if we were going to do a lot of walking, we reckon we would need frequent changes of socks, especially if we were going to be a long time. Couple of sets of underwear, if you had that many, and a shirt or two. And those who had them, a spare pair of boots. Myself, I didn't have a spare pair. In the event, our plans and assumptions proved to be perfectly correct. We stowed all this stuff from the Red Cross parcel store into our homemade kit bags, and we were ready for the road within the hour. Now, the Marines, friends of mine, they thought that they were going to get one over on us. When they went down the store, they didn't do as we did, anywhere near to the same extent anyway. What they did was take the Red Cross packing cases, which were nothing more or less than three-ply tea chests, they took them to pieces, and they built themselves a little cart. Well, three-ply can in some cases be strong, but when it's got to carry kit bags and you've got to make wheels from it in order to move the cart, those wheels are not going to be very strong. However, everybody set out. We marched up the road out of the camp. Within about half a mile, the Marines' tea chest wheel cart started to disintegrate. First one wheel fell off, then another wheel fell off. They put them back on again. They fell off again. And then other bits of their cart started to disintegrate. Until in the end, they just had to give it up as a bad job, take their kit bags and load them up with what had been on the cart and carry it as best they could. So they didn't have the laugh on us. We had it on them. Now, when we got away from the camp, we turned east towards Hamburg. We hadn't been on the road for more than 2 hours before we were strafed by Allied planes. In this case, we saw these planes, we recognised them as ours, and therefore we didn't think that they would come down and strafe us, but they did. This was our first experience of being strafed. Fortunately, they didn't hit anybody.
These were British fighters, were they?
Yeah, Hurricanes. We got away with that one. As I say, we hadn't been on the road more than 2 hours. Now, the Germans, of course, had their gear carried for them in a cart, driven by a Pole and his son, and there were a couple of horses hauling it along. I think the boy was about 14 years old. All their gear was stowed in the cart. Obviously, if they were going to look after us, they couldn't be loaded down with kit bags, rucksacks and that sort of thing. They needed to be free to move if it was necessary. Now, the strafing that we had that afternoon gave me food for thought, because I found that when the planes came down, having to carry my kit bag hampered the speed of my movements. So I thought to myself, well, if that cart can carry the Germans' gear, why shouldn't it carry mine? So no sooner thought than I sneaked up behind the cart and on went my kit bag. And that left me unencumbered. And I was strolling along quite happily, no kit bag, no weight, beautiful, marvellous. And I came across one of our officers, a Lieutenant Robin Evans. And he, like the rest of them, was carting his few belongings. And he was making rather heavy weather of it. And I must confess that his pack seemed to be far too big for what he really needed. However, he'd been my boss on board, and I said to him, it looks as though you're finding it hard going, sir, and he said, yes, I'm afraid I am, Macy. So I said, well, all right, I'll give you a hand. Give me your pack, I'll carry it for a little while. So he said, well, where's yours? Haven't you got any? I said, never mind where mine is. I'll give you a hand with yours. So I carried his pack for him for about an hour. Well, we didn't travel very far that afternoon. And our first stop to bed down for the evening was on open, marshy ground. I didn't like the look of it at all. It was very marshy. And as night came down, a mist rose from the ground, making it even wetter. Anyway, we got ourselves settled down and made a brew and opened some of the tins, we dozen chaps. And after we finished our meal, such as it was, I decided to have a wander around and see how everybody else was getting on. And I went over to where there were some of the officers, not our officers, but other naval officers. And I couldn't believe my eyes, because they were getting ready to turn in. They got blankets. Some of them were undressed. In pyjamas, even. And I thought to myself, well, this is crazy. Here am I. I've been got rid of my own stuff. I've helped one of our officers out. And if those people are carrying blankets and pyjamas, then 10 chances to 1, so are ours. So why should I put myself out and help Lieutenant Robin Evans again carry his pack if he was doing the same as them? Because all we had was just our overcoat and hat. Nothing else. No blankets, nothing. And we used our kit bags as a pillow. Well, of course, being on marshy ground, the wet seeped through, the mist hung about, and throughout the night we became thoroughly soaked. By the morning we were cold and wet, inside and out. However, we had an early morning brew. We were on the road, I think, by about 7 o'clock the next morning. And after the experience of the afternoon with the strafing, we kept a watchful eye on aircraft activity. About mid-morning, we were strafed again. And again, we got away with it. No one was hurt or killed or anything like that. At the end of the morning, we passed through a small town called Zaphon. And about 1400, we were resting by the roadside when out of nowhere came 4 hurricanes, and they strafed across the road. Well, Jock Chalmers, my mucker in, and I both grabbed nearby kit bags, placed them round our head, and I turned my head to port, and I could see the shells hitting the deck just a few feet away from me. And he said afterwards that he saw them hitting the deck a few feet away from him. So by some great good fortune, we must have been under the nose of the plane, because the shells were going each side of us. However, we didn't get away with it this time. There were 2 waves of aircraft which came over. And this is where my captain, Commander Schofield, had both his legs shot off. He was near the German cart with all their gear on it, and he must have been standing by one of the wheels, and the shells from one of the planes went through the spokes of the wheel and cut his legs off right near the top. I saw him fall down. I wasn't very far away. And after the first wave came over, I rushed over to him. I saw him lying on the deck with his legs just hanging in a grotesque position. And I asked him if I could help him. And he said, "No, Macy, there's nothing that you can do for me. Get away from here. Look after yourself." He said, "And that is an order. Go." Well, I was very reluctant to leave him, really, the state that he was in. But he told me to go, so I went. And the next lot of aircraft were making a move to turn round, as I could see, and come back and strafe again. So I dashed across a field to where there was a sort of small barn affair. I tried to get in this, but it was absolutely jam-packed with Kriegers. I couldn't get in. So I had a look at the sky to see where I thought these planes were going to make their run. And I got on the side of the hut, furthest from where I thought they were coming across. I was right, as I found out. And they came over and they strafed across the road again. And then 2 more planes came down the road, strafing all the way down the road. But again, in that case, no one else was hurt. But with my captain, Commander Schofield, three others were killed. Sorry, two others were killed and two more were wounded. And so the Germans, or the German in charge of the column, when it was all over, he sent back to Zeifen for an ambulance to take the killed and wounded, and also to procure two more horses, because the two poor beasts that were pulling the cart had had their bellies ripped out by the shells. They'd ripped straight through their bellies and they had to be shot. So two more horses had to be procured somehow, and they got them from Zeifen.
Could I ask you at this point to what extent this column was identified, would have been identifiable from the air?
Well, I was going to bring this point up later on, actually, when we came to meeting the inmates of Stalag Luft 3, who were also on the road at the same time as us.
Well, we can leave it till then.
Yes. All right, we'll leave it till then. Now, not far up the road from where all this took place was a village. And there was a small hill on the far side of the village, and it was covered in pines. And it was decided that we should bed down in these pines for the night. And it was lovely there because it was nice and dry and warm and soft. We made fires to cook our bits and pieces of food and to make a brew of tea or coffee or what have you. And, of course, being amongst the pine trees, aircraft couldn't get at us. They made two or three runs over this pine wood because the light of the fires indicated to them that's where we were. But, of course, they couldn't get at us through the trees. So we spent a comparatively peaceful and comfortable and certainly dry night. Now, although we'd only been on the road a couple of days, we'd had two meals out of our small stock of food, and there wasn't an awful lot left because, as I said, we loaded up with things other than food. Currency. So it was decided that as Jock Chalmers and I could speak the language fairly well, which we could, he'd learnt his from a book, I'd learnt mine by bartering with the guards down at the gate to the compound in the camp. It was decided then that we would go hunting every day for food, taking some of our currency with us to buy it with. And that's exactly what we did. So, the next morning, we worked our way towards the back of the column, and we had a little yarn with the guards, and we found out where we were making for that night. And at an auspicious moment, on went our kit bags onto the cart. We already had Red Cross boxes with us, parcel boxes, that is. And we slipped the column. The guards didn't see us go. And we went out into the countryside searching for food. And every morning this happened, and we ate well every night. and we were the envy of others who either didn't think of it or thought it was too risky. But on this first morning, we came to a small village,